All right, guys, if you're still finishing up, go ahead and do that and get those in. If you finish up and are done with it, I guess just hang on to it, bring it up after, because we're gonna go ahead and get going, because we're a few minutes late. Let's just go ahead and be honest. I'm no Shane Wood, I'm no Mark Scott, but that's okay, because I don't know if it is okay, actually. That's not okay at all. But I want to speak to you guys a lot today, just kind of as a fellow student, as somebody who's here with you, as somebody who's at Ozark, somebody going through this culture. I think there's a lot that we can take for our community here at school. I think there's a lot that Jesus says to us in concluding this sermon in Matthew 7 that we can really apply to our community at Ozark in our specific context in classes and as a very specific kind of Christian community and a ministry training community. I think there's a lot to say to us. So I really want to speak to you just as another student, as somebody learning this with you, as somebody experiencing this with you, that we can kind of shape our community and how we grow together through how Jesus finishes up this sermon. And in talking about how he finishes up, talk about what he's done already, because this is obviously kind of a big deal, this sermon. So I'm excited to finish that up for you. Mark Scott, yesterday I talked to him, and he said, yeah, Ben, you know, it was that right after this class, we're walking, and he said, yeah, so just go ahead and finish up the Sermon on the Mount, just finish that up. Yeah, just finish the Sermon on the Mount, because that's not a big deal. But yeah, I'm excited about our text this morning. I think it'll be good. I want to pray, and then we'll get started. Holy God, thank you so much for this class, for this opportunity. Thank you for bringing us together this early in the morning to study and to learn about Jesus, to hear what he says to us about being Christians and about being holy and about being a people called out and a people called for a specific reason, for a specific purpose. We pray that we would be those people, and we pray that we would accept the call that Jesus lays forth to us that is not an easy one. But we pray for boldness, and we pray for the authority of Jesus' words to speak power into our own lives today. And it's in his name we pray. Amen. All right, well, there's something about the end of a sermon that is kind of important. I don't want to impose, you know, like Western homiletics or any kind of homiletics for that matter onto Jesus and what he's doing and how he teaches and how he preaches. But there is something about the end of a sermon. There's something about the end of a discourse, something about the end of a monologue that's a big deal. I think one of my favorite sermons I've ever heard, Mark Scott. We can't get away from him, even if we tried. Mark Scott, he preached this in chapel a few years ago. Some of you are probably here. He preached from John chapter 21, kind of the testing of Peter, the reinstatement of Peter. And the sermon was good. It was solid. It wasn't, you know, like stunning. It wasn't great through the whole thing. But I just kind of listened and was like, yeah, this is good. You know, this is fine. He just kind of went verse by verse, talking about the text. Nothing overly grabbing again. It was good until the very end. And what he said at the end made the whole thing, because he wrapped it up so well. Here's what he did. This whole sermon on Jesus reinstating Peter, on failure and how we can deal with our failure, and just those things going verse by verse. And here's what he said at the very end. He just said, and here's my dominant thought. In the words of Brother Wilson, the resurrected Christ is not what you think, because Jesus can still hit a straight lick with a crooked stick. And he walks off stage. There's something about the end of a sermon that makes it. There's something about those last thoughts, those few thoughts that sum up the themes, that just put it all together and make it work. And I think Jesus really does that here. If we look at all of these sections from chapter 7, verse 13 through 29, all of these sections, all the paragraphs, are judgment themed. They're all end themed. They all have judgment language, destruction language, all of that stuff. That's what's going on here. So Jesus has done this whole kind of discourse on discipleship thing through these last few chapters. He's gone through all of that. He's given kind of ethical standards, ethical evaluations of things in chapter 5, if we want to break it up that way, kind of a religious reevaluation or realignment in chapter 6. It says, I want you to live this way, chapter 5, and then you've been trying this way, but don't do that anymore, chapter 6. And then chapter 7, he kind of gives us specifics on how to do that and warnings on how to not do that. It starts with do not judge. You talked about yesterday. Ask, seek, knock. You need to ask for these things. It's hard. You need to ask for it, or you're not going to get it. Earlier in chapter 7. And now we come to chapter 7 and verse 13. And Jesus says this in coming to the end of his sermon. Enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. So he contrasts two ways. This happens a lot. This is a common thing. This is an Old Testament thing. Psalm 1, Deuteronomy 30. Talks about two ways. Deuteronomy 30 is that, like, God's kind of telling the people, I've given you this option, I've given you this option. Now choose life so that you can live. Because if you don't choose life, then you're, like, not going to. But Psalm 1, I love. I want to read it to you. It's pretty short. I love this. It says, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. And on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. That's one way. Whatever he does prospers. And here's the second. Not so the wicked. They're like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. See, there's two ways. There's a right and a wrong, a dark and a light, and there's always two. There's two options. You're either good or bad. You're either in or out. This is a common thing Jesus is saying. You're either going to pick the narrow way or the broad way. You're either going to pick the hard way or the easy way. One of the two. I love the word. I don't know if you want to write this down. I don't know if you want to write any of this down. You can do whatever you want. But the Greek word is poulon. Therefore, gate. And that's where we get our word pylon. I remember that in Greek 1. Freshman year, first semester, Greek 1. Kenny tells us about poulon and pylon. And how on the football field, those little orange things that they've got to get inside. That's the pylon. That's the gate. So I think about that with this. This is a narrow path. There's only one way to enter. On a football field, in between those pylons, in between those poulon, you've got to go inside. If you're not inside, it doesn't count. There's only a certain place you can go that it works. I can't go out of bounds and score a touchdown because that's outside the poulon. That's outside the pylon. So that's what Jesus is kind of saying. You've got to stay inside. There's only a certain way that it works. You've got to be inside those paths. And it's often narrow. It's difficult. It's small. You've got to stay on the path. And it's hard to see. You know, it's one thing, it's kind of like my sister went to school at Texas Tech University, and we were driving back one time from there. We'd gone to kind of pick her up, help her move out when she graduated, and I was driving back with her in a little car. It was loaded full of stuff, and we were on one of those two-lane highways, kind of between West Texas and East New Mexico. Don't go there. Really, don't go there. So we're on one of these little two-lane highways, and my sister just, she got so scared, she got so freaked out. The highway was so small, and there was a car in front of us who was going slow. She didn't want to pass it because she's so scared about moving into that other lane because there's oncoming traffic and there's not enough room. And what if I don't make it? She'd had a friend actually die in a car accident from that on a two-lane highway, moving to the outside lane to pass, didn't make it in time, and she passed away. And so she's so scared of those highways. It's too small. Sometimes it's small. It's hard to maneuver around. There's not as much room as you might like. It's not like Seinfeld, Kramer's, you know, comfort lanes, takes out the middle lane. It's not like that. It's restricted. It's narrow. It's hard. And I want to read to you from this. Can I suggest a great resource for you? I stumbled across this yesterday. This is fantastic. Shane will probably be very happy with you, honestly, if you find this book. It's Commentary on Matthew by Stanley Hauerwas. It's a winner. But let me read to you from this. This is what he says about this path. It's so good. He says that journey, the journey of getting to God, the journey of getting to Jesus, the journey of crossing the gap between man and deity, that journey takes place on the road called discipleship. Jesus does not try to entice us to undertake that journey by telling us that it will be easy or that many will join us along the way. The gate is narrow and the road is hard. Moreover, the journey is made even more difficult by false prophets who are quite good at disguising themselves as fellow travelers. Bonhoeffer bluntly tells us, so I'm getting two quotes in here, Hauerwas and Bonhoeffer. This is worth your money. To give witness and to confess the truth of Jesus, but to love the enemy of this truth, who is his enemy and our enemy, with unconditional love of Jesus Christ, that is the narrow road. To believe in Jesus' promise that those who follow should possess the earth, but to encounter the enemy unarmed, to prefer suffering injustice to doing ill, that is the narrow road. To perceive other people as being weak and wrong, but to never judge them. To proclaim the good news to them, but never to throw pearls before swine. That is a narrow road. It is an unbearable road, Bonhoeffer says. I like that. And I think there's something about this road that is not enticing. There's a lot of things about this road that's not enticing. I don't want to travel this road. And when we jump ahead to Matthew 10, Jesus sends out his disciples, and all he promises them is suffering. The only thing in the Gospels Jesus ever promises his people when they go out is suffering. He says, I want you to go out and do this. I want you to go out and tell people. And he doesn't say, it'll be great and you'll have fun and you'll get to go to CIY and it'll be a blast and you're going to have great memories and you're going to win the dodgeball tournament or come in second place this summer. But that's okay. He doesn't say those things. I mean, maybe that happens, but he doesn't say that. The only things Jesus promises is suffering. That's it. He says, you're going to go be beaten. You're going to go die. You're going to be mocked. You're not going to be welcome. You're going to be kicked out of the house. That's it. That's what we've got. But Jesus doesn't try to make it any other way. He doesn't. I love what Hauerwas says there. He doesn't try to entice us to it by saying it's going to be easy. He doesn't even try to entice us to it by saying, that's okay, lots of people are going to be there with you. It's going to be great. You can build friendships and relationships and community. He doesn't even say that. He says, get on the road. There's not many people there. But you got to go. You've got to travel it. That's the road we've got to look forward to. And in some strange way, here's what's beautiful about the gospel. That road that is suffering and that's narrow and that's hard and that's not enticing, even the way Jesus paints it, still that road is the best. And still that road is joyful. And still there's no other road I'd rather go on than that road. And after you've done it for a while, I'm sure any of you in this room would say the same thing. I'm sure a lot of you in this room could probably say, like I do in some way, you know, I've tried other roads. And it's cool for a while, but I'm not going back. I'm not going back to that road. I'll stay on the narrow road every time. There's something about the difficulty of Jesus' call that is still so wonderful. And I don't know what it is, because it makes no sense. But it's fantastic. But Jesus is very black and white here. It's, again, those two ways. It's either right or wrong, in or out. And I don't know where those lines are. We have this tendency when we see those things. You know, even when we talk about it, there are two ways. There's good and there's bad. There's narrow and broad. Then we start thinking, okay, well, where are the ways? Where are the lines? How do we know? Which road are we on? That's what we jump to right away. We want to know. Am I there? Is he there? Are they there? How can I get people here? If they're on the other road, I want them on this road. But Jesus doesn't tell us that. He just tells us there's two. And then I look back to the beginning of chapter 7. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. I don't know what it is about the sermon. Jesus just tells us what's going to happen. He doesn't tell us how to deal with it. I don't know. He can kind of do what he wants, I guess. He's Jesus. But he does leave that way open for us. It's white or black, but I'll tell you which is white or black. So, interesting. And I think that we can really kind of take that home for us in a lot of ways. But here at Ozark, here is training for ministry. People, a lot of us have been Christians for a while. I've been in the church forever. I was baptized when I was like 5. People have been in the church forever. People who've grown up there, people who are going to be there. Then how do we do this? How do we talk about the narrow road? How do we go about not being presumptuous? How do we not assume too much? Because I at least start to ask the question as soon as I read this then. I ask the question expecting a negative answer. I ask the question almost laughingly, like in Luke chapter 10, I believe. When someone comes to Jesus and says, so what then? Are only a few going to be saved? So not many are going to be saved. And I ask that question like, okay, God, really? So you're just not going to save very many? The road's that narrow? And I think he says, yeah, you're right. And so I think there's something for us, even us at Ozark, even us training for ministry, even us going to be the future leaders of the church, the current leaders of the church, for that matter. There's something to examine in ourselves. Which road are you traveling? Are you willing to actually encounter the words of Jesus? Let him confront you with his demands and say, I will travel that narrow path. I will suffer. And I'm not suffering now. Maybe that means I'm doing something wrong. Are we really willing to confront Jesus and let him really get in our face and mess with us? Kind of turn things over, throw things around. I think that he wants to confront us, even us at Ozark. I think we need to check which path we're on, day in, day out, day in and day out. I love what a guy, what's his name? Daryl Guter? You remember Drew? Guter? Yeah. Daryl Guter. This is fantastic. He's talking about church. He's talking about preaching. And he's talking, here's the word, re-evangelization. Re-evangelization. I think oftentimes we kind of think of evangelism, evangelization, evangelizing as kind of a one-step thing. I'm going to go evangelize and they're going to be baptized. And now the process changed and we're making disciples. Right? I kind of see that. I see that distinction a little bit. I see that happen. But what Guder says is the church, every gathering, every Sunday, the church is constantly re-evangelized. You never cease to be evangelized because every time the gospel is preached, it encounters you again. You encounter it again. It confronts you. It challenges you. It steps up to right into your face, looks into your eyes, and just surprises you every time. We're constantly being re-evangelized. It never stops. We're being shaped. We're being molded. Always changed. So I would challenge you, I would challenge me, challenge us, students here. Go to chapel and be re-evangelized. Open yourselves to the gospel again. Let it fine-tune, let it sand down those corners. Let it get rid of the rough spots. Let it rub you till it hurts. Kind of that holy sandpaper kind of thing. But let the gospel confront you. Okay, we can move on. I could probably stay there for a while. All right, verse 15. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. So who are these false prophets? If you spend much time in the New Testament, you'll realize they're everywhere. They're just about everything. It almost seems like Paul's kind of paranoid. Like, Paul, you know, you don't have to bring up false prophets again. It's going to be okay. You know, we've heard before. We heard last chapter. You don't need to bring it up again. 11 times in the Greek New Testament, you'll see false prophets, this pseudo-prophetes, Greek students. False prophets. It's like pseudepigrapha, false writing. False prophets. You see all the time in the New Testament, all over. Here's my favorite place for it. 2 Peter chapter 2. The whole chapter. The whole chapter. Now, here, try to do this. A couple years ago at the, last year, the place I was preaching, the little church I was preaching at, I tried to preach 2 Peter 2. I was just going through 2 Peter. And got to 2 Peter 2 and I thought, how on earth do I teach this to a small congregation of like 10 to 12 people? This is a whole chapter talking about do not let false prophets in. These people, the same people, have been in the church for like 30 years. I don't know what to say about that. The only person, as I was thinking about it, is like, well, the only person in this congregation that I could see being worried about being a false prophet because they're new and because they're teaching is me. I'm like the only one teaching. So I was preaching this sermon the whole time thinking like, man, I hope that they don't listen too closely because I might get fired this week if they pay attention. So, by the way, the answer is I still don't know how to preach that text to a congregation. So don't come to me for help on that one. But yeah, false prophets is everywhere. It's everywhere. And I like what Matthew says here, that they're like wolves in sheep's clothing. It's a deceptive thing. It's a really deceptive thing. It's like the prophets in Jeremiah 6. Who he kind of gets after for saying peace, peace, when there is no peace. The idea you get from reading Jeremiah isn't that these people are just naive or hopeful or stupid. The idea you get is that they're trying to convince people that there's peace, everything's great, you're fine with God. Don't worry, you're doing great. It's okay to go worship Baal every once in a while too, that's fine. It's okay to mingle with the government the way you're doing and kind of commit adultery from God. That's you're fine. It's all peace. It's all fine. That's the idea you get. And I think that's kind of the same thing Matthew's saying here. He's really bringing this Jewish audience's attention back to Old Testament, back to false prophet stuff, because it's all over there. If you think it's in the New Testament, it's all over in the prophets. So it's really this idea of deception. This isn't just people who are wrong. This isn't just somebody saying something you don't agree with. I don't think that's what Matthew's getting at. It's not just false prophets like, well, I disagree with you. We can bicker on this doctrine, but that's okay. He's talking about people with motives that are coming in to deceive and to lead people astray purposely. That's why he talks about wolves in sheep's clothing. It's not just that they're wrong. They're really trying to deceive actively. Okay, so fruit. By their fruit you will know them. We're supposed to watch out for false prophets. All through the New Testament it tells us to watch out for false prophets. All through the Old Testament it tells us to watch out for false prophets. Everywhere, watch out for false prophets. Get rid of false prophets. Keep them out of the assembly. Confront false prophets. All of these things. Well, how are you supposed to know them? Jesus is helpful in this one. You'll know them by their fruit. Because you're not going to get figs from a grapevine and vice versa. You're not going to get apples from a pear tree. You'll know them by their fruit. You'll know what's happening by their fruit. Here, Josephus, because, you know, Kenny taught me how to use these little green books with Greek in them. Josephus talks about, when he's talking about the Israelites wandering in the desert before they get to Sinai, he talks about them wandering, obviously, in the desert. It's hot. He talks about it just kind of being like barren and ugly and hot, and they're all mad and they're grumbling and it's uncomfortable, and they're looking for water. They've just been at the place where the water was bitter, right? So they complain about that for a long time, and then Moses fixed it, and then they left right after the water got good to drink. So they're still wandering through the desert, and it's not comfortable, and they don't like it. I've actually been there in the desert, and I didn't like it either. I wanted to stay in my nice little air-conditioned tour bus, and that was just fine. I can see out the window plenty. So I can't imagine wandering in the desert, especially with these, you know, however many, you know, people they had. It would take forever. But they're wandering through the desert, uncomfortable, don't like it, sweaty, nasty. They're mad at Moses. They're mad about the water. They're starting to do that whole I want to be back in Egypt thing. And then they see kind of this oasis on the horizon. They see these palm trees. They see this green and this water, and it looks so nice. And so they say, let's go over there. Moses, let's go over there. So Moses says, all right, we'll get over there. That'll be nice. These palm trees look beautiful. As they got closer, they started to realize, those don't look so good anymore. And as they really got up to them, they realized that the palm trees didn't have water. They were withered and dry because of lack of water. And even though they looked great from afar, there was no fruit. There was nothing in that little oasis at all. And I kind of see that's what these false prophets are like. You see them and you can see these people teaching. You see these people being charismatic. You can see these people being excited. You can see these people coming in that seem so great. And then the closer you get, you realize there's no fruit here. There's no fruit here at all. And you can start to tell when what happens is deception. You can start to tell when what happens is people being misled, is people not being won to the same gospel we see in Matthew 5, Matthew 6. I think that's what we have to compare to here. False prophets are going to come in and distort the message that Jesus has brought. Well, what's the message Jesus has brought? It's Matthew 5 and 6. So if the fruit that these prophets are producing is not Matthew 5 and 6 fruit, well, then that's the problem. That's the false prophet. So, and he says to watch out for those people. Don't tolerate those people. Earlier in chapter 3, John the Baptist is talking about branches that won't bear fruit. And he's kind of talking about the Pharisees and those things. He just gets right in their face. But he says the axe is already at the root of the tree. The axe is already at the base of the tree. Every branch that does not bear fruit is going to be cut off. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near. Sometimes I wish I could preach like John, and that'd be okay. And then I remember that he got beheaded. Maybe I still need to preach like John. I don't know. But Jesus is always pretty bold, and John is always pretty bold about trees that don't produce fruit, branches that don't produce fruit. So, we need to examine that fruit. We need to know our stuff. We need to know our doctrine. We need to know what we believe. We need to know what hills we'll die on. So that when we're confronted with those hills, and know if we're going to climb the hill, know if we're going to fight on the hill, know if we can see somebody's being deceptive, somebody's misleading. Not just if somebody's wrong and you disagree, but if somebody's misleading, if somebody is this false prophet, if somebody's trying to look great and have no fruit, if somebody is trying to be that wolf in sheep's clothing and sneak into the herd and then just carry off lamb after lamb after lamb after lamb, what are we going to do about that? How do we do that? As Ozark students. Like I said, this is all over the Bible. So this is my fifth year here. I've heard false prophet stuff a lot. And when I hear it, honestly, I'm not sure what to do. Because I know if I'm going to produce fruit and keep them in Matthew 5 and 6, I know I'm not to judge. I know I'm to love. I know all those things. So what am I supposed to do with false prophets? Well, I think the best thing that we can do is know our doctrine, know your theology, know what you believe, know the Bible. Because when you know those things, you know which hills you're willing to die on. When you know those things, when you see false prophets, when you see deception, you're ready to take it and you're ready to do something about it because you know. And so you're willing to take it on. You're willing to take a fight for that. So know your stuff. Don't just go through this school thinking like I did for a while that like, well, you know, all that end time stuff, I just don't care about that. That's not that important. Honestly, I don't like talking about end time stuff. It's not fun. It's not enjoyable. And I do think it's kind of silly. It just doesn't bother me which millennial view you hold or I hold. I don't like to talk about it. But people do. And when you get in the church, you're going to be asked that all the time. All the time. I preached a sermon series on Revelation at that same little church. And I was trying to just talk about like, no, we don't need to just think future. We don't need to think future. We need to think now. What does Revelation say now? And I'm trying to, the whole sermon series was that, the whole thing. And still, after almost every single Sunday, people will come up to me with questions about end times, questions about millennial views, questions about that. That's what's on their mind. Whether it should be or not, whether I think that's the best thing or not, whether I think it's important or not, whether I've even said in my sermon, I don't want to talk about that or not. That's what's on people's mind. That's what you'll get asked. You'll get asked that. You'll get asked about pacifism. I don't know where you fall on that issue, but know it. It's a big issue. It's a real issue. Know it. You'll get asked about these things. That's so easy as a student of this stuff to think, you know, big picture, I'm not going to break fellowship over that. That's a matter of opinion. Inerrancy is a matter of opinion. I'm not going to break fellowship over that. Okay? But know it. Know the hill you're going to die on. Don't take this stuff lightly. Everything you learn here, even when it seems fun, when it seems not fun, when it seems important or not, these are hills that you're going to have to decide if you'll fight on and die on or not, because people are going to ask. And I'm still learning this. I'm not arrived. That's why it's on my heart, because I'm learning it now. I'm experiencing this now. And at church, I go out and preach. I'm experiencing these questions. I'm hearing these things. And I want to talk about it. But don't, let's not take our time for Ozark, our time at Ozark, for granted. Because what we're learning is so important. It's so important. So don't take that for granted, please. And again, know the difference. Know the difference. This is maybe the second thing against false prophets. The first would be to know your doctrine. The second thing would be know the difference between a wolf in sheep's clothing and a misled sheep. Because I think there is a difference. I think there's a different way to handle it. And talking about trying to figure out what hills you're going to die on, I think I'm a lot more ready to die on a hill against a wolf in sheep's clothing than I am against a misled sheep. When I'm dealing with a misled sheep, I may kind of climb up the hill with him, try to coax him back down, right? But when I go up there with a wolf, I'm not coming down until the wolf's done being a wolf. So know your doctrine and know the difference between a wolf in sheep's clothing and a misled sheep. Verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who's in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Well, Lord, Lord, again, Greek students, that's the vocative. That's calling, that's urgent, that's a plea, that's trying to get attention, that's yelling. It's like our what's the phrase? I don't remember. It's a plea. It's urgent. Remember that. So I mean, these are people that are hurting. These are people that are calling out to him, Lord, Lord, hear me, please. By the way, you may want to make note of this. This is the first time Jesus is called Lord in the Gospel of Matthew. The word kurios is the first time Jesus is called that in this Gospel. But these people are calling out, and these are people that kind of seem like they've been doing good things. They've been prophesying. They've been driving out demons. They've been doing good things. And still they call out to him, and he says, I don't even know you. And there's a difference, I think, between... I hope you can read my writing. A little bit, at least. There's a difference between orthodoxy... and orthopraxy. There's a difference between being able to say the right things, know the right things, think the right things, and then really grabbing the right things, doing the right things, owning them. There's a difference there. I think there's a difference between you hear this all the time. I hear this all the time. People say, I got a friend back home. We were friends in high school, and he believes. I mean, he believes in God, but So I think there is some difference there. There's a difference between just knowing it. There's a difference between being able to say, I believe there's a God. Sure, I believe there's a God. Well, but have you owned him? Do you know him? Have you taken him? Have you accepted him? Do you do these things? Do you let this sermon confront you? Do you let the Gospels change you? I think there is a difference there. And I think that's what Jesus is saying. You know, I've told you these things. Matthew 5, 6, 7. I've told you these things. And he's saying, there's going to be people that come up to me and say, Lord, yeah, but look what I've been doing. He says, well, but have you done Matthew 5 and 6? Have you been in Matthew 5 and 6? Have you accepted Matthew 5 and 6? Have you joined that kingdom? Or are you still trying to fight some other battle? Have you joined that kingdom with those values and those ethics and those religious re-standardized things and re-evaluation? Have you joined onto that kingdom? Have you signed up for that kingdom? Have you fought for that kingdom? Because that's the one that matters. I don't really care what else you do. I think that's what Jesus is saying. I don't really care what else you do. Have you listened to me today? Have you done Matthew 5, 6, 7? Have you accepted these values that seem so upside down to the world, but really are right side up? I think this is kind of related. We say this a lot. I say this a lot. That Jesus' kingdom is the upside down kingdom. Right? That he turns everything upside down. Everything, he changes it all. Really, I think Jesus is the one that's right side up. I mean, it's quibbling over semantics, but let's be honest. Jesus is the kingdom that's right side up. And we have messed it up. We've perverted it. We've turned it upside down. But Jesus sets values right back where they're supposed to be in Matthew chapter 5 when he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the meek. That's what values are supposed to be from the beginning of time. And Jesus sets them right. So I think that's what he's going to ask. Not can you say the right things? Not have you been doing, you know, something that you think is so great? Have you really come in contact with Jesus? And at the end of that passage, he says, I will tell them plainly. The Greek is confess. I will confess to them. I never knew you. Away from evildoers. I never knew. That word for know, that's the word gnosko. That's the deep, intimate knowing. That's relationship knowing. That's knowing everything. That's close. No. If we go back to Psalm 1, at the very end, for the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Watches over. The Lord watches over. In Hebrew, yada. In Septuagint, gnosko. No. The Lord knows the righteous. He doesn't know the wicked. He knows the righteous, doesn't know the wicked. And he'll say on that day, depart from me, I never knew you. You were walking a different path. You were walking that second path that are like chaff and blown away. I never knew you. I never gnosko you. And I think that this is for Ozark as well. I think maybe more than other things in this passage. This is for Ozark. I never knew you. But Lord, I preached every Sunday. But Lord, I did youth ministry. Lord, I went to CIY every summer for 15 years. But Lord, I went on mission trips. I was there. Maybe I even went to Afghanistan. I went to Iraq. I did those things for you. And he'll say, yeah, but did you know me? Did you know me? Did you walk the path with me? That path of suffering. That path that's not fun. That path that's lonely. That path that's small. The path that's scary. Did you walk that path with me? Do you know me? Yeah, but Lord, I've been preaching every Sunday for the past 2.5 years. But Ben, did you know me? I think that this speaks to Ozark maybe more than anything else in my text this morning. Do you know him? And we do it different ways. Different people do it different ways. I remember in my Christian life class freshman year. This is the one thing I remember that class, actually. But it's good. I had it with Dave Smith before he left, and we talked about spiritual pathways. As soon as he said, we're going to talk about spiritual pathways, I went, oh, that sounds cheesy. But it was good. It was good. Talked about different people being sensates, naturalists, intellectual, the ways that you encounter God best. Because creation is God's, revelation is God's, personalities are God's creation. And Dave Smith would say, if I go to the Grand Canyon and walk out and see that creation, and I'm outside and I go hiking down inside it, and can just look out and then come back up, and I'm seeing the sunrise, seeing the sunset, he would say, I gnosko God. For some people, they could sit down and read a book. They can sit down and read this, just cover to cover. And when they get done, they just say, man, I gnosko God, because you've encountered him. Some people would say, you know, I just went to an old lady's house in my church. Wasn't expecting us to come. Didn't know we were coming. I just went to her house. We cleaned things up, did some yard work, raked some leaves, sat down and had a meal with her. And when they leave, they say, man, I gnosko God, I know. We do it different ways. But he's going to ask. He's going to ask, do you know me? Have you found me? Have you experienced me? Have you worshipped me in creation? Have you studied me? Have you let me get inside? He's going to ask, do you know him? Find out how you know him best. And get there. Know him. Love him. Because he's going to ask. Mark Scott always says one of the occupational hazards of this place is that the things of God become common. I've been there. I don't know about you. I've been there. I've definitely been there. I've been there Saturday night when I think, I would do anything else in the world rather than write this sermon. Anything else in the world. This is so annoying. I don't even like this. I don't care. I don't have anything good to say. They don't want to hear me. They'll be better off if I just don't go. I'm going to sleep in. You know, I've been there. I lose that moment. I lose the power. I've been in chapel. I've been in chapel. Where it's been a busy week. You got lots of memory work. You got a test the next day. You've been up late. You've already written three, four, five papers. I've been to chapel those days. And people get up to worship and all I can think is, I don't like this song. Or even as a drummer, I'll think, you know, I would have done that differently. Because I lose that moment. Somebody gets up to preach, and I turn on my little homiletical ears and think, well, that was a bad introduction. -5. I've been in those moments. I've been there. And you lose it, you know. It's easy for those moments to just pass by. And they become common. They're not powerful moments anymore. But he's going to ask, do you know me? Have you encountered me again and again? Have you been re-evangelized? And again, I think that this all connects to the rest of the Sermon on the Mount too. Not only have you found you knowing me and what works for you to know me, whether it's outside or in a book or in smells and sounds and liturgy, not only have you found the way you know me, that's part of it. Here's the other part. Do you know? Do you know? Not just do you know, but do you know? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Do you know, blessed are those who mourn? Do you know, blessed are the meek? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness? Blessed are the merciful? Blessed are the pure in heart? Blessed are the peacemakers? Blessed are those who persecuted? Do you know that? Do you experientially know that? I think that's the other thing he asks. Not just can you find the way your personality connects? Not just can you find the way I feed you? But have you experienced what I've said about the way life should be? Not only do you know that Jesus said blesses the poor. Wow, that's interesting. That's different than I would have thought. I need to tithe more. Sign up for a compassion kit. Not only do you know that, But have you gone to serve the poor, live with the poor? Go rent an apartment in a poor neighborhood. Buy a house in a poor neighborhood and live there. Do you know that? Do you know, blessed are the peacemakers? Have you gone into situations to make peace instead of adding to the argument? Instead of adding to the trouble? Instead of bringing your own 2 cents and your own opinion and your own, you know, ideas that are just going to fire everything up again? Have you gone in to make peace? Do you know? Do you know me? He's going to ask. He's going to ask. See, all of this is judgment language. All of chapter 7 is judgment language. He's given this whole sermon and he's saying, now be ready, because I'm coming. Alright. Verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down and the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. One of these great stories. We could all probably sing the song. We don't need to do that. That's okay. Jesus says, therefore, verse 24, therefore, this is cheesy, but it works. Rick Warren, my church did the 40 Days of Purpose, purpose-driven life thing several years ago. I don't know if any of you have done that. It's all right. But Rick Warren always says, and I remember hearing this when I was young and being like, okay, that's really cheesy. I will never repeat that. Here it comes. I'm about to, because it's actually not bad. Every time you see therefore in the Bible, ready? Read on and see what it's there for. That's so great. But seriously, it's not bad though. Because it stuck with me. And every time I see that word therefore, I think, well, we're transitioning somewhere. We're taking what just happened and moving into a plea. We're moving into an exhortation. We're moving into something important. So therefore, Jesus is still talking about, he's still talking about people that knew him or didn't know him. Still talking about people that profess him and don't know. He's still talking about that. Narrow path, broad path. So therefore, in light of all that, in light of don't judge, ask, seek, knock, narrow paths, false prophets, those who don't know me. In light of all that, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like, that's the parable formula, is like, hamoios. Somebody is like. It is like a sower. It is like the man. It is like the woman. It is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. Everyone who hears and puts into practice. Therefore, take all of these things. And when I start to read, wise man built his house upon the rock, then I start to think, oh, yeah, VBS, cool, yeah, good story. I remember this. This is great. The house came tumbling down, and we all roll around the ground, and it's fun. And that's cool. But this is still judgment language. This is still caution. And he's not just saying, this will be fun, build your house. He's saying, judgment is coming. Rain is coming. And the rain's going to come whether you're righteous or wicked. The rain's going to come whether you built it on the rock or the sand. The rain's going to come. He's saying be careful. Don't. This isn't just a fun story. He's saying you need to hear these things and do them. You need to know me. You need to know them. Do these things. Do these things. What time is it? Somebody? Tento. Okay. One last thing. We're almost there. This is good though. This is the best thing. Okay? Hear this. I'm excited about this. Last couple of verses. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Okay, the sermon's done. Sermon's done. Everybody walks away amazed because Jesus taught with authority, not like the scribes, not like the Pharisees, not like the rabbis. They just quote everybody else and ask a bunch of questions. Jesus said, this is the way it's going to be. He changed everything. He had authority. He made it real. He spoke with power. He revolutionized everything. He revolutionized the religious system. He completely changed ethics the way they knew them then, the way we know them now. Everything has changed. He spoke with authority. And that is what keeps us going to churches week in and week out. That's what keeps me going to the church that I preached at for 2 years. And when I started there, had 20 people. And when I left, had 10. There's an Ozark success story for you. That's not what's supposed to happen. But that's what keeps you going every week when people have stopped coming. And when nobody's there. And some days in the summer, 4 people show up to church. And you keep preaching anyway. Because Jesus' words had authority. And if he had enough authority to teach like this, then he has enough authority to demand my life. And I will give it to him. And I will give him everything in Matthew 5. I will give him everything in Matthew 6. I will change my ethics. I will change my morals. I will change my religion. I will give it all to him because he spoke with authority. Not like scribes and prophets. Not like teachers today. Not like anybody else. Jesus spoke with authority. So when he demands my life, he gets my life. And I'll keep preaching. And I'll keep serving. And I'll keep dying to myself because he gets it. And when he said in Acts 1 verse 8, you will receive power, I believe that because he spoke with authority. He told me I'll receive power, and so I will go out and say it. And when nobody shows up to hear, I'll say it again. And when nobody listens, I'll say it again. And it's because he spoke with authority, it's because he spoke with authority that I will pray. I will pray for Jeremiah 20 and verse 9. That even if I say I will not speak any more of his name. Now hear me, I'm not just talking about preachers. All of us, we got something to say. Even if I say I will not speak any more of his name, his word is like a fire in my bones that I cannot contain, and I'm weary of holding it in. I can't hold it in. I pray that because Jesus' words had authority and they're different than anyone else's words. I pray Jeremiah 20 verse 9 for this campus because Jesus taught with authority, so we give him everything. That's all I got. Thanks, guys. Have a good day.